From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Well, last night's debate changed the momentum. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In Colorado this morning, President Obama gave an energetic stump speech, but even Democrats agree he was uninspired last night compared to Mitt Romney. Republicans are cheering Romney's aggressive performance. Both sides are wondering why the president failed to seize several obvious opportunities. Was he out of practice? Was it part of his campaign strategy? Will a different Obama turn up the next time around? In the meantime, can Romney use positive news coverage to establish a lead among potential American voters? On Reporter's Notebook later on, The Good Girls Revolt at Newsweek magazine. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. The early consensus is that an aggressive Mitt Romney won last night's debate against a president who was defensive and lacking in energy. We'll hear the early reaction and ask how it might influence the remaining month of a close and hard-fought campaign. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll hear the story of women who went to court to overcome male discrimination at Newsweek magazine. First, this news update. After a Syrian mortar strike accidentally killed five Turkish civilians yesterday, Turkey retaliated with artillery attacks against Syria. Today, Turkey's parliament authorized military cross-border operations. Liz Sly of The Washington Post is covering the conflict from Beirut, Lebanon. Good to have you back on our program.
Hello.
Did the Turkish retaliation, the artillery fire, kill anybody in Syria?
Well, the Syrians have reported to the United Nations that two of their soldiers were injured. That's all we know so far.
Have they apologized for their earlier attack on Turkey?
They have not apologized. If you read the letter closely, which I've been doing, it doesn't amount to an apology at all. They're not saying they did it to start with. And they're also saying that even if they did do it, there were good reasons for them to have done it, such as that they're facing a terrorist threat, and they indirectly blame Turkey for facilitating that terrorist threat because Turkey, as we know, has been allowing Syrians from the opposition levels, members of the Free Syrian Army, to freely cross in and out of Turkey.
What about Turkey's parliamentary action today? What does that actually mean when they authorize cross-border operations? Are they at war with Syria?
No, they're not at war with Syria. The move today in Turkey's parliament does is it gives the government a blanket authorization to conduct military operations in foreign countries for the next year, and it doesn't mention Syria by name. It's a bit like, you know, the War Powers Act in War Powers vote in Congress. It's authorized military action, not specifically against Turkey, and it doesn't mean that military action is going to take place. But it just ratchets things up a little bit because it now means the government has political authority to undertake any action that it wants to take in the future if these incidents continue to escalate.
Turkey does have a history of cross-border actions, particularly into Iraq against the Kurds.
Well, yes, but you have to remember that the Kurds don't quite have the same kind of arsenal of weaponry at their disposal that the Syrians do. And that going into Kurdistan with operations as they do isn't quite the same as it would be going into Syria. Syria has an air force, it has missiles, it has Scud missiles, it has sophisticated surface-to-air missiles. It could inflict a lot of damage on Turkey, whereas the Kurds really aren't in any position to do that at all. So I think we are looking at slightly at apples and oranges when we talk about those two situations.
Has there been other cross-border action of this sort regarding Lebanon, for example, or Jordan?
Well, yes, shells have landed in Lebanon. They've killed Lebanese. Syrian fire has killed Lebanese. I remember I was up on the border in Lebanon in May 2011, and two people died that day from two Lebanese died that day, including a soldier, from bullets, I think it was in that instance, fired from Syria into Lebanon. But both Lebanon is not in quite the same position as Turkey with regard to the Syrian government. It's a much weaker government. It's a much weaker army. It's not in a position to retaliate. But the Lebanese have been getting very frustrated. And the Jordanians have also had shells landing in their territory, but they haven't actually had civilians killed. So they haven't actually taken any action yet. And this is not the first time shells have landed in Turkey, but it is the first time that Turkish civilians have died, which is why this is a much more serious incident.
There is international concern about this. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, has expressed a great concern. There's apparently a dispute going on about whether the Security Council should pass a resolution of some kind. In the meantime, Russia, of course, which has been standing up for Syria, I take it has taken a position as to what Syria should do about all of this. What is that?
Well, Russia's deputy foreign minister actually came out with, no, the foreign minister, not the deputy foreign minister, the foreign minister actually came out with quite an interesting statement today. I think he's visiting Islamabad, and he said that Syria should apologize for this attack, admit that it did it, apologize and say it won't happen again, so that everybody can move on. And Syria has not done that with that letter to the UN. So you also even wonder how much influence Russia has over Syria.
What about relations in the past between Syria and Turkey? Haven't they been allies?
Syria and Turkey were building allies for a few years before this revolution erupted in 2011. But in the 1990s, they had extremely hostile relations. They nearly went to war in the late 1990s over Syria's government allowing Kurdish guerrillas to conduct attacks from Syrian territory inside Turkey. And there was some massing of troops on either side. It was possibly even closer to war than we've come now. So there isn't actually a long history of close relations, but recently they had significantly warmed their relations, and those warming ties have dramatically unraveled over the past year.
All right. Illustrating again, as you indicated, how serious the situation this might turn out to be. Liz Sly, as always, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us from Beirut.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Again, Liz Sly with the Washington Post in Lebanon. In a moment, will last night's debate change the campaign momentum? On To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. In last night's debate, Mitt Romney was an aggressive challenger, not afraid to accuse a sitting president of not telling the truth.
Look, I got five boys. I'm used to people saying something that's not always true, but just keep on repeating it and ultimately hoping I'll believe it. But that is not the case, all right? I will not reduce the taxes paid by high-income Americans.
For his part, the president accused Romney of shifting ground and backing away from positions he's been taking in his campaign.
For 18 months, he's been running on this tax plan. And now, 5 weeks before the election, he's saying that his big, bold idea is never mind.
Rich Galen is a Republican strategist who handled communications when Newt Gingrich was House Speaker. He was not involved in Gingrich's presidential campaign this year, but he was a very attentive watcher of the debate last night. Rich Galen, as always, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you.
What about that exchange? Wasn't the president right that Mitt Romney has said he would not reduce the taxes paid by high-income Americans?
Well, in all of these things, it's the— It's the parsing.
Excuse me, I said he would. He has contradicted himself. I beg your pardon. Go ahead.
It's the parsing of the parson. I think what the shift was whether or not he would reduce rates, the marginal income tax rate, and I think the adjustment has been that now the rates will stay the same under a Romney plan, but they'll pay the savings or the difference will come in the way that. Exemptions and deductions are handled. That's something that Marty Feldstein started raising a couple of weeks ago. That you can have, if you make $250,000 a year, say, you can have this total number of deductions and exemptions. If you want to use your mortgage deduction, that you can use that. You can use health premiums, whatever you want to do. You can pick and choose from a menu. But it can't go over that amount.
Okay. So immediately when you start talking about the differences that came out last night, you get into the weeds and you start talking about things that probably many of the 58 million people who were watching the debate may not have been able to follow.
That's right. They would have gone immediately to NCIS reruns.
Okay. How did the debate itself go, though, in terms of who won and who lost from your point of view?
I don't think there's any – I mean, no matter who you talk to, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or Democrat, anybody not on – the Obama campaign payroll, has been honest about it and said this was not a good performance by the president for whatever set of reasons, that it was a very good performance by Romney for whatever set of reasons, and Romney won the debate. Does that mean he wins the election? No, it means he won one night's event.
One night's event. Rich Galen, Republican strategist. Susan Estrich is a professor of law at USC. She's a syndicated columnist. In 1988, she was campaign manager for Michael Dukakis' presidential campaign. Always good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, and good to be here with my buddy Rich.
All right. You're not on the Obama payroll.
No.
Do you agree with Rich Galen that, and many others, that the president lost this one?
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, the polls all show that, and as we all know, polls are always right. But I think when the conventional wisdom that sets in that Romney won, Romney won. But as Rich says, this is debate number one, and there's a bit of a curse of the incumbent. I was there back when Mondale won the first debate against President Reagan, and we all know what happened then. John Kerry won the first debate against George W. Bush, and again, I think most of us remember that. So I think there is a tendency, first, when an incumbent gets on the stage with the president, he always gets a bump from that. And second, he was more assertive last night. And frankly, I'm not sure I understand the substance of what you and Rich were just talking about, but I thought Romney's reference to his kids and, you know, they say the same things over and over, humanized him in a way that he needed.
So he was humanized, and the president was not. We've been hearing in recent reports that the president appears to be a much more humane and available and accessible person than Romney.
Well, you know, that's what everybody thought coming in, but I thought the president was a little stiff last night. I thought he was a little bit unemotional. He didn't make any mistakes. He didn't liberate Poland. It was a bit boring in all that talk. And he didn't, in a sense, stick anything to Romney. He didn't raise the auto bailout. He didn't raise the 47%. I think his debate performance was a little bit like an incumbent who thinks the election is over, and this one isn't.
Of course, former President Ford was the one who liberated Poland when he was in a debate some years ago, a tremendous embarrassment to him. Rich Galen, back to you. Were you surprised by what happened last night? Did the president, do you think, fail to live up to that expectation that he was the one who was most able to reach ordinary Americans most directly?
Yes, of course. But that's part of the game that Susan and I have both played, and she's been way better at it than I have, which is to try to adjust expectations going in so no matter what happens, you can claim victory. And I mean, we've both been through, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of debate prep sessions. But my suspicion is that the Obama team felt that they wanted to minimize exactly what Susan was saying, that allowing just being on the same stage with the president elevated Romney, and they wanted to minimize that elevation, so he didn't directly engage him, he didn't look at him very much. They always had him looking down, like he was making notes to refute whatever Romney was saying. I think all those things they tend to be generally well thought out, well planned. In this case, it just didn't work, but they'll fix that for the next one.
Susan Estrich, a lot of people are saying that what's really important about the president is what he didn't say rather than what he did. He didn't mention the 47% of Americans
right.
that Mitt Romney said don't matter. He didn't mention Bain Capital. He didn't mention a whole lot of things.
I think Rich is right. I think to some extent there was clearly a strategy there to be, as we say, strong, positive, and not engaged. I think what you're going to see now is it's going to be Romney's polls will go up a little bit. His fundraising will go up a lot. There'll be, I mean, I'm getting emails right and left, you know, where was Obama last night? And it's not from people who are going to change their vote, by the way. It's just from people who are used to Obama electrifying a room, and this was not a huge room. And I think you'll see a different Obama in the next debate. And the expectations for Romney will be much higher. So we may see a little bit of a flip there. But I think the thing we all have to be careful about is declaring this election over. It's a tight race. It's been a tight race for a long time. And it's going to stay a tight race, I think, until the end.
I want to point out that the Gallup poll, which does tracking poll, reports that in the 3 days leading up to last night, and does not include any post-debate fall-off for the president. His approval rating went up 4% to 54%, his highest rating since 2009. I'm wondering, Rich Galen, if that surprises or concerns you, do you think that will dramatically have changed?
No, I don't think that will dramatically have changed. I think the head-to-head will change, and I think it may be a five-day track. Or not a three-day track, but I might be wrong about that.
Thank you. If that's right, I thought it was 3 days. But
I noticed that this afternoon as well when I looked at the Gallup numbers. I think that has more to do with the fact that that Americans are beginning to feel better about the economy generally. That they think they've been through the worst of it, and they think we're coming out the other end finally. So I think that the debate is a tactical. A moment in time, I think, as a strategy, though, the president, if he can, it depends on what happens with the job numbers tomorrow, assuming they don't shock anybody. But I think you may see a shift in the Obama campaign to beginning to at least stick their toe in the water of taking some credit for an improving economy, which happens to fit, I think, the public mood.
Jonathan Last is a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, a conservative magazine. Jonathan Last, good to have you on our program.
Hey there.
Is there a danger, is there a risk for Mitt Romney and the Republicans at this point to overplay what happened last night?
Well, probably not. I mean, they've been running this campaign since the end of the Wisconsin primary, and something good had to happen to them eventually, right? And Romney had a very, very good night. It was the strongest debate performance of his that I've seen in any of his election cycles. I actually disagree that the president did badly. I think he had a sort of first do no harm approach. But within the construct he created for himself, I thought he was perfectly fine. He was just outclassed because Romney was very, very good, and the Romney camp I think is right to sort of ride this for as much as they can get. You know, the best upside historically for a challenger following a debate in this is about 3 points in the polls once all the tracking is said and done in 6 days, and. You know, if he could approach something like that, it would be very, very good for him. The only problem is, at the end of the day, he's still Mitt Romney.
What do you mean by a first do no harm approach? That's a great analogy.
I thought it was pretty clear that what the president was doing was trying to, not really engage, don't look like he's trying to punch out and look, desperate or vicious against Romney. That's why I think he didn't bring up the 47% or any of that stuff. He didn't want to look like he was grasping, particularly. Not until he had felt Romney out a little bit and seen, how good Romney was on his feet. And plus, you had to assume that if you're the Obama camp, that any possible obvious attack you would do on that, the Romney people have already prepared for. So I thought it was actually a reasonably smart thing for Obama to do. He just was unlucky that Romney had a very, very good night.
Michael Grunwald is senior national correspondent for Time magazine. He's author of The New Deal, The Hidden History of Change in the Obama Era, a book very favorable to the president. Michael Grunwald, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Are you disappointed this morning?
Well, I don't really have a rooting interest, but I thought the president was horrible. I thought he kind of let Romney get away with completely reinventing himself as sort of this dessert candidate who likes all the good stuff in Obamacare and likes all the good stuff in financial reform and has plenty of tax cuts for middle-class people, and is going to just fix it all through getting rid of deductions and loopholes without actually naming whether they're going to be, charitable deductions or home mortgage interest deductions or, deductions for savings or child tax credits. Obama really let him skate. He didn't really seem to want to tell the story of his last 4 years. And that seems to be a real problem for him. I understand that he elections are about the future, not the past. But he let Romney just sort of criticize the last 4 years without really responding. I thought the ultimate example was where Romney claimed that half of the companies that got stimulus money for clean energy have gone bankrupt. And having written a book about it, I know that it's way less than 1% of those companies have gone bankrupt. But Obama just let it go right by.
Let's hear what Mitt Romney said further with regard to the clean energy issue. Here's an excerpt from his remarks.
You put $90 billion like 50 years worth of breaks into solar and wind, to Solyndra and Fisker and Tesla and Enter One. I mean, I had a friend who said, you don't just pick the winners and losers, you pick the losers.
Michael Grinwell, back to you. This is something you're very interested in. How could Obama have responded to that? He didn't have much to say.
Well, for one thing, he might have talked about some of the winners, right? Companies like NVIDIA Systems that got a stimulus grant and has invented the world's most powerful battery for electric vehicles that's going to cut $5,000 to $6,000 off the cost of the next Chevy Volt. He could have talked about how wind power has doubled on his watch and solar power has increased more than 600%. And more than that, he could have made a case for why you do this kind of stuff. Like, he should be bragging about putting $90 billion into green energy. There ought to be a great debate about this kind of thing, but Obama just, it was like it's taken for granted that that's a bad thing, rather than talking about the importance of reducing our dependence on Middle East petro-thugs and reducing carbon emissions that are broiling the planet and reducing our vulnerability to price shocks that drop us into recession every time a hurricane or something happens in the Middle East, and creating millions of jobs in these exciting new industries that people seem to think are the wave of the future, where the U.S. has this real kind of innovation advantage. Obama just let it pass like he didn't want to talk about it because the stimulus falls badly, and it does. But at some point, if he's just going to let let Romney talk about how the last 4 years are a joke, and he's not going to respond, people are going to start to agree with that.
So, Jonathan, last with the Weekly Standard, you indicated that you thought this wasn't so much a bad performance by Obama as it was a good performance by Romney. But would you have to concede that he could have made a much better case in response to many of the things that Romney said?
Yeah, I think he could have. But, I mean, there's also a downside to doing that. You know, I mean, if you come out and really sort of testily engage this challenger who you're leading in most polls by about 5 points, there's also the chance that you come across as a little desperate. If you sort of just take as given that the challenger is always going to do better in these debates, these first debates, because they are elevated just by standing on the stage with the incumbent. Look, again, I'm not trying to, you know, minimize it. Obama could have done better. He certainly lost the night. But I think, you know, his strategy wasn't insane.
Susan Estrich, back to you. Again, the campaign manager for Michael Dukakis's presidential campaign. Would you agree with that, that the incumbent might look desperate if, in fact, he were doing a better job than either you or Michael Grinwald think he should have?
Look, it's a nuanced issue. I think, you know, I don't think he was horrible. I think Romney, who's been through a lot of debates in the last year and has gotten much better, showed himself well against the president. But I do think he was a bit disengaged. And I do think there were opportunities, without being mean or nasty or sticking a finger in anybody's face, there certainly were opportunities, as you mentioned.
Okay, hold that thought. Hold that thought. We need to go to a break. We'll come back, continue this conversation on Reporter's Notebook later. The Good Girls Revolt at Newsweek magazine. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
We're only back with To the Point, talking about last night's debate, why it turned out the way that it did, with most people saying, even Democrats, that President Obama didn't act as presidential, perhaps, as Mitt Romney, certainly wasn't as aggressive. We've heard various explanations for why that might have been. We've also heard a reference to the campaign involving Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan. Let's look at a bit of history and how it might shed some light on what happened last night. Michael Severn is professor of law at Columbia University. He's president emeritus of Columbia. He played Ronald Reagan in debate preparations for Walter Mondale when he was the challenger. Professor Severn, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
So you were the sitting president at the time, and Walter Mondale was the challenger. What did you learn from that experience that might shed some light on what happened last night?
Well, the point has already been made several times that the challenger always gets a boost from the elevation to parity with the president. I also learned that the victory, even a lopsided one in the first debate, doesn't predict either the outcome of the second debate, which in Fritz Mondale's case was generally judged to be a standoff, nor, of course, does it predict the outcome of the election. Fritz carried Minnesota, and that was it. I agree with everyone that Romney did win last night. I'm happy to say, though I'm not happy with the outcome, that I had predicted that in a piece in the New York Times last Sunday. So I was not surprised. I was surprised by the what one has to characterize as the strategic choice of do no harm, or as I thought of it, play it safe. That isn't inconsistent with at least pressing on some of the debate. I was reminded of a congressional hearing some years ago in which a witness was pressed for details, and he said, let's not get bogged down in specifics. And the interrogator says, why not? We're already bogged down in generalities. Obama let Romney get away with general statements that were highly vulnerable, and he could have pressed against that, I think, without seeming to be a nag or a desperate harpy.
So do you think, then, that this was a conscious strategy, or is this part of what's often been referred to as the syndrome of the presidential bubble, where you're simply not used to having people stand in front of you and criticize you the way Mitt Romney criticized Barack Obama last night? Mr. Obama has been behind the bubble with the sycophants surrounding him for the past 4 years and hasn't had any debates.
I think probably both were at work. I do believe they would have given careful thought to the image they want to project and how to do it. I think that's fairly obvious, and that would have been the statesmanlike, not a mean-spirited antagonist. But the bubble is a real problem. I never asked Fritz Mondale why he asked me to be his Reagan, but my theory at the time was he had been my student, and he could be reasonably confident that I wasn't afraid of him. And would push him around. And I don't know who besides Michelle can do that with the president.
Did you push him around?
Yes.
What'd you say?
Well, we had a wonderful set to in which he was waxing eloquent about Medicare and talked about how his father had been a minister, never a wealthy man, and had left his mother with limited resources. His mother became ill. And when those resources were exhausted, if it hadn't been for Medicare, his mother would have had to go on welfare. And as Ronald Reagan and I said, that's a very moving story, but I like to think that Mrs. Mondale's son would have helped out. He turned and said, you son of a bitch.
and you weren't offended by that?
No, of course not.
Sure. Mr. Obama has been very disdainful of Mitt Romney, apparently very much so in private. Was there a risk then that he might have let that show even more than he did? He did smirk a lot when Romney was talking, but he didn't say much that indicated that kind of opinion. So when you say he was playing it safe, maybe that was the best course.
Well, except the proof is in the pudding, and when you get a consensus view that he didn't look good, and not merely that he lost, but that he seemed weak, disaffected, distracted, that's not helpful. So that the strategic judgment may have been sound, but then execution is at fault.
And Michael Severn, again, a professor of law at Columbia University, president emeritus there, played Reagan in the preparation dates with Walter Mondale. Jonathan Last with the Weekly Standard, let me go back to you. Do you think the president actually looked weak?
I don't know. I don't think he looked weak. I think he looked a little bit listless and a little bit disengaged. But the truth is also he's never been a master debater. He went up against John McCain, who himself was quite middling last time around. He's had very few contentious exchanges with the press corps during his 4 years compared to other presidents. This is not an arena in which he is hugely familiar, whereas Mitt Romney, ran for president in 2008 as well as this time around. He's been in a lot of these debates, and I think experience does tell.
So, Michael Grunwald, should we be so surprised then that the president didn't perform better? Maybe he was overhyped to begin with.
No, I think this goes to a sort of sort of problem at the heart of his candidacy, if not at his presidency, which is that he's having trouble articulating why he deserves four more years. I think it's clear that he'd like to talk about the future, and he feels that he doesn't want to be sort of bragging about his achievements at a time when Americans are hurting. There's plenty of polls that suggest that kind of focus groups badly. But at some point, he's got to sort of make the case that, yes, you are better off than you were 4 years ago when the economy was falling apart, as well as, my policies for the next 4 years are better than the other guys. Because if he's not willing to defend the last 4 years, I think people are going to really wonder why he deserves another four.
A moment ago, Susan Estrich mentioned the possibility that this might be good for fundraising for Mitt Romney. Michael Grunewald, you live in Florida. Early voting is underway in Florida. Do you
not
think?
Yet. Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Well, it's about to begin. Let's put it that way. It is one of the early voting states. The absentees, I think, already are sending in their ballots. Do you think this performance last night is likely to reduce the turnout, as it were, for President Obama?
I'm not a very good pundit predictor guy. What I will say is that I do think that he's going to have to make a sort of positive case for his presidency. He ran on change in 2008. I mean, I wrote a book that's all about, how he actually did lots of change in healthcare and education and energy in the way the economy is structured. He talked a little bit about some education reform and some of the tax cuts that have gone to more than 95% of the country. But he didn't really make a coherent case that even just that things are less bad than they would have been without him, because if he doesn't make that case, I think people will be suspicious that he can actually make things not bad in the next 4 years.
Susan Estrich, you ran a campaign, once again, for Michael Dukakis in 1988. There wasn't an incumbent in that race. George W. Bush was the opponent. But what about the concern now that there might be an impact from the debate on the early voting, which many people think is going to make a huge difference?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think a lot of the early voters, and again, you can't really tell, but a lot of the early voters tend to be people who are absolutely certain of their vote, who are not waiting to see, who are not part of that sliver that is uncommitted and undecided. And I think if you are part of that sliver, you might well say, well, look, this one was good. I was leaning this way. I'm not so sure. Let me watch out. I do think, and I agree with everybody here, that there's a line he's got to walk. I saw an ad online just demonstrating and detailing all of Obama's accomplishments in the last 3.5 years, and it said at the bottom, so what have you been doing? And I think at some point he's got to do that list, because he has accomplished a lot. The economy, we've seen the last few months, confidence is growing. And, if you can't make any case at all about the past, then how do you make a case that people shouldn't be disappointed? And I think there are people in that middle group who did vote for Obama last time and need to believe that they did the right thing and should do it again.
As we were saying at the very beginning of the program, they did get into the weeds on a lot of issues. Let's just, for the benefit of our listeners, turn to one of those, which had to do with spending cuts. First, here is Mitt Romney.
What things would I cut from spending? Well, first of all, I will eliminate all programs by this test if they don't pass it. Is the program so critical it's worth borrowing money from China to pay for it? And if not, I'll get rid of it.
And here's President Obama on the issue of tax rates and what they might mean in the context of spending cuts.
The fact is that if you are lowering the rates the way you described, Governor, then it is not possible to come up with enough deductions and loopholes that only affect high-income individuals to avoid either raising the deficit or burdening the middle class. It's math. It's arithmetic.
So, Rich Galen, sort of apples and oranges in those two sound bites. But what about the overall concern or the attacks on Mitt Romney that he hasn't provided enough detail to flesh out his programs? Is that something the president could have taken advantage of last month?
Well, let me present an alternate reality here from, I think, what almost everybody else has said. I mean, one of the reasons, maybe the reason, that Obama didn't counterattack, as everybody has suggested he might have
might have done. He just didn't know enough to be able to counterattack. He didn't know what the percentage was of loans to alternative energy. He didn't know. I mean, just I don't think he gets into the weeds about anything. I don't think he cares about the details. And so he just didn't know enough to be able to take Romney to task to the extent that there was tasking to be taken. So, no, I mean, I just don't think he knew enough.
Michael Grunwald, would you agree with that? Is the president uninformed?
No, not really. I mean, I think he certainly has a sense that of the tens of thousands of stimulus companies that got green energy money, I know of four that failed. I think he knows that's less than half. I think it was more a question of being a little uncomfortable about defending his record at a time when people are not feeling great. But I think to a certain extent, he's got to get over it. If the question is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, he's got to make a case that, you know, he didn't mention gays in the military. He didn't mention immigration. He barely mentioned the auto bailout. And he didn't mention except for his opening statement, he didn't mention the fact that they've created 5 million new private sector jobs over the last couple of years, that all the job losses were in that first year that after he inherited the mess. I know he's afraid to look backwards. He thinks that looks weak, but I think it beats the alternative of just allowing Romney to beat up on the last 4 years without a response.
Jonathan Last with the Weekly Standard. Mitt Romney, of course, has had more time to study up than the president has. Do we want a president who is familiar with all the details? Jimmy Carter was criticized for that.
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing. I think Rich makes an excellent point. President Obama has never been known for being a wonk. Bill Clinton certainly would have responded differently because this is what kept him up at night. I mean, you know, he was just reading through reports. He was reading through white papers. He was into this sort of thing. I don't think that there's ever been any indication, even from sympathetic biographers, that that is the style of presidency that Barack Obama runs. Now, you needn't be like that to be a successful president, but also, you know, you can be wonkish and be a successful president. It is not necessary, but it is sufficient.
Michael Severn, you played Ronald Reagan in the debate preps for Walter Mondale. You didn't have to be a wonk to act like Ronald Reagan.
No, but you do have to be ready for what's likely to happen in the debate, so that while I agree with the comments that were just made that he's not a wonkish president, he has to have known that he was going to get hit by Romney on the investments in alternative energy, and he should have swatted up on whatever detail he needed to be ready for that. So it's possible he can get caught with a surprise, but the lines of attack were predictable, and so responses should have been at hand.
Susan Estrich, what do you anticipate for the next debate?
I anticipate that they will be working to show the president more passionate, more able to hit back. I agree with Michael completely. I've written more debate books than I care to count. And I don't care what he's been doing for the last 3 years. These attacks were predictable, and I promise you the numbers were in the debate book. But I think he's got to be more engaged, more passionate, stronger about his record, and be willing, without looking like a bully or a jerk, to take on Romney on critical issues and draw those lines so that Romney has to defend himself. I mean, frankly, Romney hardly had to defend himself on anything last night.
Susan Estrich, again, campaign manager for Michael Dukakis' campaign, now professor of law at USC. Rich Galen with Newt Romney when he was speaker, not with him as a presidential candidate. What do you anticipate for the next debate?
Oh, I suspect that they'll completely change their theory of how they want to conduct it. I mean, if I had been in the room, I might have agreed that this was the right approach. But after actually seeing it, you got to say, well, that didn't happen. Let's turn this thing around. Let's do what Reagan did in his second debate and take it to him a little bit.
Michael Grunwald, your prediction?
Yeah, I think even his speech today in Denver, you got to see he was a lot more aggressive, and he actually was touting his record a lot more, talking about how he had doubled renewable electricity over the last 4 years and cut middle-class taxes, and definitely opened up the new front on that this is a new Mitt Romney that he had never seen before, right? That who was this guy who claims that he isn't interested in cutting taxes and claims that he has is interested in protecting healthcare patients who have pre-existing conditions and interested in protecting Wall Street reform when he's been running around saying he wants to repeal it. I think they feel that they can use Romney's shifts during the debate to at least sort of open up a new line of attack. We'll see if it works.
And Jonathan Last with the Weekly Standard, final question to you. How do you think this the next debate will be different from this one?
It all depends on the positioning in the polls. If it turns out that this debate moved the needle, if we have a closer race, if it is nip and tuck, I think they'll both approach it differently. Romney will try to be, I think, even a little more aggressive still. The president will be forced to do that as well. But if not, if it turns out that the race is basically where it is now, I say there's really no way to know what they'll do, and I wouldn't be surprised if the president basically does what he did now but tries to be a little bit more engaged.
Okay, the next presidential debate's a couple of weeks from now. There is a vice presidential debate coming up next week. We'll, of course, have full coverage of that, and that should be a pretty good show as well. Thanks to you all very much for being on our program today. It seems routine now to read the work of women reporters, but that's only been true for a generation. It didn't happen without a fight. And there's still a struggle going on. Even now, male bylines are 7 times more frequent than those of females in major magazines. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/To the Point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @To the Point_KCRW.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In 1975, Lynn Povich became the first woman editor of Newsweek magazine, having started out as a secretary. But her rise from an entry-level position to senior management was different from those of the men who preceded her. It took legal action. She's written a book about the process entitled The Good Girls Revolt, how the women of Newsweek sued their bosses and changed the workplace. She is now here in our studio at KCRW in Santa Monica. Lynn Povich, good to see you.
Thank you, Warren. I just want to say I was the first woman senior editor.
Senior editor. Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying that. Nonetheless, there was a fight. Tell us, who are the good girls who revolted?
Well, we were the generation of women who were raised in the 40s and 50s where the expectation was you might get a job. You didn't necessarily ever hear the word career. And you'd have a job until you got married or had children. And that was the sort of expectation. So we came up believing that until we came of age and went into the workforce in the 60s and had to make this enormous transformation with the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, to suddenly realize that this was a discriminatory way of describing women's roles, and we had to challenge our bosses and challenge everything we were raised to believe.
You were involved with some good girls who turned out to be pretty powerful characters.
Yes. I mean, there were interesting women. The women who came to Newsweek at the time were told that if women want to write at Newsweek, they should go someplace else. So the women who wanted to write, like Nora Ephron and Jane Bryan Quinn, Ellen Goodman, actually stayed at Newsweek, saw they would never get promoted out of the research category, and left. And at the same time, the owner of Newsweek was a woman, Katharine Graham, who owned the Washington Post, which owned Newsweek. And when she was informed of our lawsuit, she very famously said, "Which side am I supposed to be on?"
Which side was she on?
She was an insecure new boss. She had stepped in after her husband had died. But she was also one of the few women owners of media and was discriminated against herself. So between being a woman and being a boss, it was a very confusing role.
So, again, some high-powered people left the magazine, but others stayed, including yourself. And did you sort of look around at some point and say, wait a minute, I could do as good a job as this guy over here, maybe even a better one?
Yes, I think I pushed myself forward for exactly that way. Not that I thought I was so great, but when I saw what was being done around me, I thought, well, I could do at least as good as that.
Tell us a little bit about what it took to get the lawsuit underway and what it was like to go through that.
Well, the first, the actual forming of the lawsuit was when one of our researchers, Judy Gingold, who was a Marshall scholar and could not find a job except as a researcher, fact checker at Newsweek, talked to a lawyer who told her that the segregation by gender at Newsweek was illegal. And she didn't believe it. And the woman said, call the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which she did. They said yes. And Judy said, I don't think the guys know it's illegal. Why don't we just tell them? And the woman said, are you crazy? People with power don't give up power. They'll promote two women and that'll be the end of it. You have a very clear case, so you should sue. And one by one, we organized and decided to file suit. We hired as our lawyer another powerful woman, Eleanor Holmes Norton, the current representative from the District of Columbia to Congress.
How did you recruit people, particularly people who, as you said, were raised to think that they could have jobs but not careers and might have been very fearful about retaliation?
We were. We were terrified we'd be found out at any moment and, of course, fired. So our sort of command central for organizing was the ladies' room. And we would sort of look under the stall, see who was there, and then approach a woman at the sink and say something like, oh, I have to check this story by this guy. It's really bad, or I could do it better. And if she agreed or seemed sympathetic, we would say, you know, we're thinking about doing something. Are you interested?
So you had to make the case.
We did.
How many people ultimately, how many women employees ultimately signed on? What percentage? And how many were too fearful to do it?
We actually got all of the women researchers except for the black researchers at Newsweek. There were four or five black women there, and we asked them to join. And at that point, in 1969, their loyalty and priority was for the civil rights movement. They felt more discriminated against as blacks than as women, and they were concerned that our concerns as very highly educated, privileged white women were not the same as theirs. They were not only concerned about their careers, they had to work. They were concerned about what was happening in the black struggle. They were concerned about families and the men. And so they decided to wait to see if blacks would sue and that they would do that instead.
So you didn't just tell the men and assume that because it was illegal they were going to make major changes. How did they react when, in fact, the suit was filed?
It's interesting. The men we worked with every day, the reporters and writers, were very sympathetic. As in many organizations, the discrimination was in middle management level, and a lot of those editors were not happy with us. And in fact, the first women who tried out as writers under those editors all failed. The top editor, Osborne Elliott, was immediately told me later, knew we were right that Monday. Mm-hmm. He had put Newsweek on the map as an advocate for civil rights and against the war, and he suddenly realized, as a liberal, progressive editor, oh my gosh, right under my nose, there's this whole class of people we've been discriminating against.
Now, this took place a long time ago, and it's pointed out on the book jacket, I believe, that currently there are seven times more male bylines in magazines than there are female bylines. So is there still discrimination?
Yes, of course there is. It is subtler. It's not as blatant and obvious. But, you know, if you look at the top tier of corporate executives and media executives, it's predominantly male. As you said, bylines in Thought magazines are predominantly male. There is still, in many companies, a corporate culture that's a boys' club. And there are real problems in the workforce for working families. So what we thought was a pipeline issue, if you just got enough women in the pipeline, of course they would succeed even to the top. What you've seen over the years is what's now being called the leaky pipeline, which is that very talented women drop out when they have young children.
So would you advise women who are in the kind of position you found yourself many years ago to sue?
I think that there are things you can do before you sue. I think that you have to document that what you're feeling is a pattern and it's not just you. I think you can take that documentation to people in your company who might be sympathetic, whether it's a human resource person or a mentor or a boss. I think if you have no relief within your company to show them what's going on, then you might ask a lawyer to write a letter and see if that starts a conversation.
But in the meantime, then, you're suggesting, obviously, that the pattern does still exist, and even in the journalism profession, as you say, at what you refer to as the Thought magazines.
I do. And, I think that you see women everywhere now in journalism. You can't turn on television and see war coverage without seeing women in Iraq and Syria. So there's been enormous progress. I don't mean to say there hasn't been. As I said, there are very few women at the top of the media profession, and it's a tough profession, as you know, being in the news if you have small children. It's unpredictable. They're last-minute stories.
The book is The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. The author is Lynn Povich, a former senior editor, first senior editor at Newsweek magazine as the result of a suit. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Evan George and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.